to say, first of all, that the title is slightly misleading. Not completely misleading, but only slightly misleading. I mean, part of it is I'm sort of a sucker for Tina Turner in titles. So I get seduced into the title. And my talk today is going to be a little bit more general, I think, in terms of the history and philosophy of science of this area. But I think that there will be very strong resonances between what you heard from Eric and what you heard from Irene and some of what you'll be hearing from the other speakers today. Now, I'm going to begin with the idea that the science of animal minds is a mess. Now, I mean, in a way, I sort of also, I mean, maybe it's the same thing that attracts me to Tina Turner that attracts me to being provocative. But I also want to be fairly clear about what I mean and what I don't mean by saying the science of animal minds is a mess. I don't mean that there's some conceptual confusion here. And what's needed is some philosopher to come along and sort of axiomatize the field, you know, and to sort of set things right, you know, sort of the nice old idea of what philosophy of science was supposed to do. What I mean by saying that the science that studies animal minds is a mess is something more like the idea that it's a glorious mess. It's a mess sort of in the way that I'm a mess when I wake up in the morning and I put on two socks, each of which is sort of by on its own quite attractive and quite nice, but actually together don't really work very well. So the challenge with the science of animal minds that I really want to address and the kind of diagnosis that I want to give is that in fact there are very different sort of historical roots and historical currents that go into these studies. And this has led to a kind of chaos, a kind of diversity of methodologies, of sort of conceptual presuppositions, of research programs, and so on and so forth, that has led today to a field in which all kinds of interesting and provocative things are happening. But in some sense, the field hasn't yet, or maybe never will, coalesced into anything that sort of looks like Kuhnian normal science, right? In which there's some clarity and some coherence about research programs, about methodologies, some shared notions of what counts as progress, right? So what I want to do today is to actually try to give some explanation of why that's the case, and then make some positive, perhaps flailingly positive, but nevertheless positive suggestions about what can happen to try to move the field forward. Now, I think the first thing that one has to recognize when one talks about the sciences of animal minds is that there are two very distinct historical sources that feed into this area. One is the field that has come to be called comparative psychology, which, oddly enough, is a field that, at least in its historical origins, had really nothing to do with psychology. And the other field is cognitive ethology. Now, interestingly, comparative psychology, historically, was actually rooted in biology. And in particular, it's convenient to date the source of the rise of comparative psychology with Darwin's book, The Descent of Man, published in 1871. And the work of Darwin's great Canadian follower, George Romanes, working mostly in the 1880s. Romanes actually died a tragically early death, but I think it would have been quite interesting to see how his work would have developed had that not been the case. But it was actually almost 10 years after Darwin's publication of The Descent of Man that what today, at least, when we write the history of psychology, we regard as the founding of the first psychology laboratory in Leipzig by Wilhelm Wundt. Now it was clear in Wundt's work that what he meant by the study of consciousness was human consciousness, right? There was no interest in this case in anything that we would associate with comparative psychology cases. Psychology was meant to be the study of human consciousness. Now, we tend to say when we write the histories these days that Wundt was an introspectionist. And there's something right about that and something wrong about that. He himself was actually very critical of introspection, which he regarded as being highly unreliable. And he distinguished introspection from what he talked about as the internal perception, of our conscious states, which he thought was actually more reliable. And that actually leads into all kinds of sort of interesting philosophical discussions about the nature of intuition and ideas of rational intuition and so on and so forth. But the point is this, that psychology was founded as the study of human consciousness. And what we can broadly talk about is introspectionist methods were at the core. And so obviously, it's very difficult to do this as comparative cognition, right? Because you can't actually ask the parrots or the apes. Maybe you can ask the parrots, but you can't ask the apes. You can't ask a lot of creatures to sort of report on the flow of their conscious states. Now, there's a very interesting history, I think, about the development of comparative psychology, because actually what happened is something like this field migrated into psychology departments, despite its roots in biology, actually going through the sort of behaviorist period when people used animals as surrogates in the study of human behavior, but for the most part eschewed talk about consciousness. But so you had this idea of comparative behavior, and then once ideas of consciousness in the study of mental states comes back, then you sort of have the accoutrements, you have the trappings that will support some field of comparative psychology that now exists in psychology departments. But actually, it's sort of interesting. I think the first professional study, society that calls itself a comparative psychology society, wasn't actually founded until the 1980s, and the main society in the 1990s. Now, the other strand that goes into the study of animal behavior is cognitive ethology, also a subject rooted in biology and conveniently dated from the publication of Don Griffin's book, The Question of Animal Awareness, in 1976. Now, Griffin is an interesting character for all sorts of reasons, and one reason Griffin is interesting is because he was not a classical ethologist or a classical animal behaviorist. Griffin's early work was much more in physiology, neurophysiology, became famous for the study of bat echolocation and so on. But Griffin's sources, as sort of the founder of cognitive ethology, actually don't come out of ethology, at least in the classical sense of the term. Now, Colin Allen, who will speak this afternoon, has done an excellent job, I think, of describing what he calls Griffin's two planks. So I'm going to be doing a lot of the deadly thing with these kinds of talks, which is reading my PowerPoints to you as if you were not visual creatures like me. Scientists should no longer ignore questions about the intentionality of thoughts and conscious experiences of animals, and our best chance for answering such questions comes from observing animals under natural conditions, solving the kinds of problems for which their intelligence has become adapted by evolution. Now, there's two points I want to highlight here. The second point is kind of obvious, that what cognitive ethology brought is this idea that the best work is likely to be field work as opposed to laboratory work, and seeing how animals operate under the conditions in which their behaviors and mental states presumably evolve to respond to. Now, the other thing that I think is interesting and important is that when Griffin actually talks about intentionality thoughts and conscious experiences of animals, there is what philosophers would think of as a kind of Cartesian residue in Griffin. He doesn't actually think of consciousness and intentionality and thinking in the way that most cognitive scientists do. He actually thinks of it much more as sort of private, subjective states that in some sense need to be introspective to really understand. So again, one of the oddities of this field is that in some sense, Don Griffin, the great father of cognitive ethology, was neither an ethologist, right, in the classical sense, nor a cognitive scientist, right, as that field came to be understood. So if you try to orient cognitive ethology to cognitive science, then cognitive science began to develop in the 1950s, focusing really on language, particularly the work of Noam Chomsky, computers, artificial intelligence, and then a focus on human cognition, the early work of George Miller, for example. There was really no particular interest in animals in the early days of cognitive science. So, then to try to summarize some of these points, in terms of the kind of competing or different tendencies that these fields bring with them. And this is a bit of a cartoon stereotype, and there's going to be exceptions to these things, but basically comparative psychology tends to be interested in experimental paradigms, it's laboratory-based, very much focused on comparisons between humans and other animals usually, but across species. And institutionally, it tends to be centered in psychology departments, whereas cognitive ethology is field-based, tends to be focused more on species-specific studies, although there are exceptions to this, and centered in biology or zoology departments. So already I think you're beginning to see that this is a sort of attempt to build a field that has actually quite different parents. I mean, oddly, in some way, they have similar parents, Darwin, but then the histories through the 20th century become very different. Now, I want to talk then about some of the methodological issues that this kind of diversity gives rise to and how it contributes to this glorious mess. Now, one thing that happens is that people ask diverse questions. And one thing I'm particularly keen on these days, because I think it's not sufficiently noted, is that to use the sort of Chaucian language, people tend to ask questions about what animals do, and they tend to ask questions about what animals are capable of doing, as if these are the same questions. And actually, I think some of the remarks by both Irene and Eric today did a good job of sort of bringing out that difference and actually suggesting that different conditions might well give rise to very different kinds of cognitive states in different animals. And I think it's particularly problematical to sort of conflate these questions, right? So particularly when you're talking about negative results, you know, these animals don't do this, therefore they can't do this, right? They don't have these capacities, because we're looking at a very, very thin historical time slice in the natural history of these animals. We wake up one day, we take a great parrot, put him in a lab, or we have a few chimpanzees and we put them in labs. And we do some studies over 10 years or 50 years, over 100 years, and we make generalizations about what these animals can do. Well, imagine taking our Paleolithic ancestors. I mean, suppose that there were some scientists, and they wanted to know what the cognitive capacities of human beings are. Right? So they take our Paleolithic ancestors, they put them in some laboratory, study them for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, write a few articles. You probably wouldn't come to the conclusion that they're capable of building atomic bombs or searching for the largest prime number or .. And yet I think that's very much like the position that we're in when we make claims about the capacities of non-human animals on the basis of what are really very limited, historically limited, experiences with them. There's also differences between species, sort of what I call species-centric views, which are usually anthropocentric kinds of studies, and what you might think of as cognitive-centric studies. Okay, so a lot of work in this area is looking for identities, similarities, precursors, building blocks to human behaviors or human cognitive states or human moral systems or human systems of numeracy or fill in the blank and so on. So the idea is sort of taking some species, usually humans, and trying to understand sort of the evolutionary precursors of those capacities, states, abilities in humans by looking at non-human animals. It's a very different way of asking questions than if what you want to understand is cognition and how it's distributed in nature and what gives rise to it. Right? Without asking that question from a species-centered sense. Now, I think, you know, there's reasons to ask both kinds of questions and dangers in asking both kinds of questions. But I think all too often these two kinds of questions are actually conflated. And so at its worst, what we come up with, and this is a quotation from Emery and Clayton, is the classic Monty Python sketch in which scientists are embroiled in the age-old question of whether penguins are more intelligent than humans. Not surprisingly, the penguins failed human IQ tests. The penguins were then given cognitive tests in a naturalistic zoo enclosure to which they gave no meaningful responses, but non-English-speaking Swedes in the same enclosure responded in a similar vein to the penguins, right? So that's kind of the really stupid way of doing comparative psychology, which, you know, arguably all too often sometimes it approaches. Now, not only are there different questions that are being asked in this field, but there are quite diverse methods that are being brought to bear. So there are some people who do laboratory studies, some people who do naturalistic studies. There are experimental approaches, there are observational approaches. One thing that's very interesting is this, I think, is this question about sample size. So Irene, for example, has essentially made an academic career on an N of 1, which, which if you sort of take a Chomskyan-type competence view of the capacities that are being studied is perfectly okay, right? Because the capacities of gray parrots, African gray parrots, are going to be recapitulated in an African gray parrot. But of course, that's very, very different from how the study of behavior has traditionally gone on, where sample size and statistical significance is actually thought to be quite important. And then there are these questions about anecdotal methods, right? Because a lot of what goes on in terms of naturalistic observation, say the Jane Goodall, you know, the George Schaller, the Jane Goodall approach to things, right, from the point of view of sort of lab-bound traditional science, is storytelling. It's essentially the observation of an unreplicable anecdote, a kind of trust me story, where you can't really go back and check the data. You know, when George Schaller was watching, you know, was sitting in trees watching pandas for days at a time and having absolutely nothing happening except getting rained on, there weren't any video cameras around those days. There's also a diversity of foci here. So a very wide range of species are studied, and it's not all that easy to get parrot people and ape people always to actually talk to each other. And when you think about the range of species that get studied in this area, and you go to meetings in which people are talking about these issues, it often becomes very, very interesting. And you sort of get this kind of social carnivore group trying to figure out what their studies and results might have to do with people who study other animals and so on. And then, of course, there's a wide range of abilities or capacities or behaviors or states that are studied: language and communication, abstraction, causal inference, self-recognition, social knowledge, analogy. And again, I think we've heard enough today. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this field, it's not just sort of, you know, people's reports about what animals can do, but their reports about what animals can't do, given that they can do these other things, right? There's kind of a lot of sort of anomalous behavior in a sense. Like, who would think, for example, that young chimps could recognize themselves in a mirror and lose that capacity to know? Of course, I originally think of what a good driver I was when I was young and how I should be left taken off the road now. But I don't think the kind of self-concepts are supposed to work like driving abilities. So it can be quite misleading then, because you can get people who sort of get results studying some particular capacity or area that look very powerful, but yet the same animal may actually not be able to do things that you would think would be much less cognitively demanding. Now, another point that I think is not sufficiently appreciated has to do with the diversity of concepts that are employed when people talk about cognitive ethology or studying animal cognition. There are many concepts bouncing around generally in the world of cognitive science about what we mean when we talk about cognition. I mean, are we talking about theories when we talk about questions about social knowledge or other kinds of theories, simulation, interpretivism? I'm not going to go into all of this in depth, but how we're thinking about what's going on with an animal who we think is cognitive is going to matter a lot if we think that to attribute cognitive states to an animal means that you attribute a kind of representational cognitive system to that animal. Or if you have some view which is a non-representationalist view, or a view that doesn't actually require anything like a traditional computational paradigm. I think one important issue is this kind of internalism versus extended mind issue. I mean, if you have the view that what it is to be in a cognitive state is supposed to be something in some sense that's going on inside the head, that's a very different picture than if you have a kind of extended mind view of cognition where you think a cognitive state can actually be distributed beyond the skin and into the environment of the creature to whom you're attributing the state. But I don't think those differences are sufficiently acknowledged generally in the community of people who study animal minds. There's also a great diversity of explanatory tendencies, from the subgenetic to the genetic, developmental, neurological, cognitive, and cultural. And again, today we're beginning to see some explanations in play that were really kind of cultural explanations, or at least strongly environmental explanations. That if you have, you know, that if you have, I mean, so why is Coco so good with mirrors, right? When other gorillas aren't. Well, Coco has had this, you know, sort of, you know, in early days kind of grew up like a Stanford faculty grad, basically, yeah? And now has this very nice life in Hawaii. I mean, you would expect her to be very good with mirrors. She's probably good with Facebook, too. I mean, right? So there's a question sort of at what level these explanations come in and what you're sort of even willing to countenance as a real explanation, you know, for the behavior. So what I've been saying so far is that there are these different historical currents that come in to the fields, the community that studies animal minds. And that's part of the explanation, not all of it, for why we have this diversity of methodologies, this diversity of things that are studied, and so on and so forth. But there are also some background issues that I think are partially responsible for why the field is a mess. And one has to do with the extremely tiny samples that are under investigation. So, I mean, you know, even if you're sympathetic to the idea that, if you really understand one gorilla, you understand all gorillas, it actually, you know, doesn't hurt to actually know more than one gorilla. And if you think about it, you know, I mean, we talk so much about chimpanzees and what we know about chimpanzees and so on and so forth, but this is meant to be a worldwide number. So worldwide, there are less than 4,000, and these are very generous numbers, but worldwide, there are fewer than 4,000 chimpanzees held in captivity. Personally, I think that's a good thing. I would like to see that number reduced pretty radically, but there aren't very many who live in close proximity with humans. And of that number, less than 100, and the number is really probably closer to 50, have actually been used in cognitive experiments. I mean, most of them are actually being held for other purposes, biomedical research. So when you think about everything we talk about with, you know, ape language and chimpanzees this and chimpanzees that, except for the work that's been done, you know, in the field, we're actually talking about very few individuals in a very few laboratories. Secondly, all of these studies are done under weird conditions. They're done in zoos, they're done in laboratories. Talk about field studies, they're done in field stations, they're done in parks, which are kind of weird environments these days in the world we're living in, and they're reports of hunters. Now, imagine that you were a sociologist and you were wanting to learn about human beings, but you could only study human beings in prisons, bring them in laboratories or watch them sort of running wild in Yosemite National Park. You know, it would be a pretty weird conception that you would have about what people are like. There's a lot about human behavior that you would miss. And sort of even worse, there are variable conditions among all these things. Not all zoos are alike. Not all laboratories are alike. So it's not surprising that different zoos and different laboratories will elicit different behaviors in animals. Right? You can't just think, oh, we got that result in one laboratory, it should be easily replicated in another laboratory. This isn't like, I don't understand it. I mean, it's the same cell line. You know, we're using all the same laboratory materials that are manufactured by the same multinational corporation. Why should there be any differences between the results of one lab and another? No. There's extremely great variability is across laboratories here. And then one thing I think that you've got a sense of in listening to our reading is just that this stuff is damn difficult to do. I mean, even if you're just talking about one parent trying to keep him interested and focused and, you know, trying to do what you want to do and so on and so forth. For those of you, for example, that have visited things like the sites of eight language experiments and so on and so forth, I mean, the kind of initial impression you get in walking into these things is like you're in some insane, crazy nursery school gone wild. You know? And it's almost inconceivable how anybody can get anything that looks like scientific data out of such a chaotic environment. And so it's not surprising that people don't get much scientific data these days. And then there are some societal issues that help to explain the mess. There are ethical constraints on what we can do in studying animals that do make the job more difficult. There are serious economic and logistical difficulties, of which this is just one obvious one. Supporting a captive chimp for his or her life costs $300,000 to $500,000. Okay, but it's not just that. There isn't really very much funding from anywhere to do work in cognitive ethology and to work on any species. And one reason why so much of this work is what I was calling species-centric work is because a lot of research in this field, a relatively large fraction of it, is actually financed by the National Institutes for Mental Health and so on and so forth, who really actually are interested in understanding human development and want to use animal models to understand that development as opposed to actually wanting to understand what's going on in the animals in the first place. There are also very high stakes, I mean, in terms of cultural meaning and significance around this kind of research. Are we like them? Are they like us? I mean, people, you know, sort of in some sense, underneath, you know, gurgling away at some place in your consciousness, there's some fraction of this audience, it's probably a biased sample, who are hearing these stories about Alice, and they're going, you know, that parrot isn't very different from my Aunt Teresa. You know, we're really like, you know, one's got feathers, one's got skin, but you know, we're all God's creatures, or evolution made us all of it. Right? But then there's also another fraction of the population that is actually resisting this, that's wanting to see the differences, right? And to see humans as being exceptional, and so on. So there's this kind of enormous amount of cultural reading in and loading up on this work. And what I always like to say about this, and then there's all these kind of background ethical issues, you know, as if, you know, the philosopher Richard Sorabji once was making fun of the ape language experiments as somehow, you know, I mean, why are people so interested in them? Because there's this hidden premise, which goes like this: if they don't have syntax, we can eat them. You know, and if you look at it that way, I mean, it's obviously fallacious. The ethical questions are pretty importantly separate from the scientific questions. And one of the things I've been suggesting is the science has got enough problems without loading it up with all of the ethical issues, which we should talk about separately. And then recently, as probably most of you know, there have been at least one highly publicized case of research misconduct, which is a serious blow to the field in terms of the credibility of the field. And I think it's not yet played out in terms of what it does to funding patterns and so on as well. Now, what these messes lead to together is a facile dismissal of other investigators' results, either by ignoring them or explaining them away. And so one of the interesting things that happens in this literature is you'll see people write about animal cognition and simply ignore results that have been reported in other species. They just won't reference them at all. Or if they reference them, well, they feel they have to reference them, then it'll be some sort of lame attempt at explaining away the results. Like, well, this obviously matches the sample. Or there's no abstraction, it's an abstraction over here. Something, you know, or something like that, without really getting into trying to confront the results and to take them seriously and to see why they may have. And on the other hand, of course, when people's laboratories don't actually replicate results that other people have, this doesn't get in the literature, but what you hear is, well, you know, they're not nice to their animals, they have no rapport with their animals hate them, you know, of course, that we get the results and so on. So the undercurrent in this field, it's not just this diversity of, you know, it's not a rainbow field. There's this great diversity and a million threads in a single fabric. What all this leads to is a kind of dismissal of other people's results that I think flows from this kind of diversity. And this amplifies the difficulty of building a science that has common research questions, methodologies, and conceptual frameworks, namely the idea of normal science. Okay, so I'm going to try not to go on too long, but it's off to a bad start in that regard. So this is a bit of a new beginning then. Okay, so that's kind of the diagnosis. And so now it's meant to be a turn about where to go to from here. So I think it's clear to be about, first of all, about what is and what is not an issue. So I don't think it's seriously an issue that many animals act, perceive, have experiences, including pains, and some forms of social understanding. So there's this enormous argument about theory of mind, which I think sort of obscures the fact that it's not controversial, that whatever is going on, many animals have social understanding, however we explain that and whatever the dimensions of that are. It's also uncontroversial that there are species-specific behaviors, beaver dam building, spider web spinning, and like it or not, human language, as philosophers and linguists understand it, is a specifically human behavior. Okay. Now, there are questions about its relationship to other kinds of communication systems and so on. What's controversial is how to interpret the observations, how to continue these lists, right? So each of those lists are dot, 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 what animals can do, what species specific, and how to explain these observations. Now, one thing I do want to say is that lots of people think that the task of explaining human cognition and human behavior is qualitatively different from the task of explaining non-human cognition and behavior. And that's because of the existence of language. That language essentially is a game changer in terms of the explanatory challenge. And I want to deny that. I think that's a mistake. That basically the game we're in is trying to understand behavior and cognition, and language is just more of the same. Maybe more sophisticated, maybe there are, certainly true, there are cognitive states that you can't have without language and so on and so forth. But when I ask you, for example, why did you close the window, and you said, because I'm cold, that isn't a game stopper in terms of explanation. That's just some verbal behavior that you're engaging in, okay? Which may or may not, and in various ways, give me explanatory insight into what's going on. But it's not, in principle, any different from a chimp going, right? It's just more behavior that has to go into the interpretations that we give. Whoops, what did I do? Okay. So the point here then is that, at least from my perspective, the task of understanding the minds of animals, the minds of other people, and more controversially, our own minds, all present similar challenges, that there aren't really qualitative differences with respect to the problem of understanding minds, whether it's a species distinction or even whether it's a self-knowledge, other knowledge distinction. They all present similar challenges. Okay, so I'm going to try to do this very quickly in 5 minutes. So the task of understanding minds, understanding cognition, starts in what I call the transactional perspective. Our understanding of other minds is rooted in these transactions of everyday life. The sympathetic and empathetic forms of identification are a part of it. Dan Dennett years ago talked about the intentional stance, hugely important, but it's one of several kinds of stances that are part of what I call the transactional perspective. One thing that has gone wrong in some research is that sometimes people try to investigate the cognitive states of animals as if you can even begin the study without approaching it through this transactional perspective. And as a matter of fact, they don't. The transactional perspective is always there, it doesn't appear in the articles. It's what helps set up the articles. So we're interested in making others intelligible, living with them productively. That involves background knowledge, appreciation of context. All of this stuff goes in to making the attributions that we make. Okay, it's not just what appears in the article, it's the discrimination task. Now, there is a special problem in cognitive studies. Generally, there's this issue, general issue in philosophy of science, again, somewhat controversial. It has to do with the determination of theories by data. But I think there's an additional problem, which I call a problem of indeterminacy, that enters with the study of cognition. And even if we knew all the discriminations an animal would make in all possible stimuli and whether variances in response were due to discriminations on stimuli or changes in state through time or circumstance, there would still be indeterminacy about what state to attribute. And that's because there are always different ways of accommodating belief states and desire-like states. So my classic example is of my old dog Greta, whose behavior is scratching at the door. Does she want to urinate and believes that an appropriate place lies beyond the door? Does she want to play with Jethro and believes that he's outside? How I fix the desire determines or affects how I fix the belief. And there is no unique description which I am compelled to take. And even if I find out what Greta does beyond the door, again, that's more data that is open to other explanations and other descriptions. So this slackness in attributions, I think, is ineliminable, and part of what we do in everyday life and in folk psychology is to regiment this indeterminacy in this slackness. It's enough that I know that you want to meet me for a drink at 5:00. I don't actually need to know your history of alcoholism or lack, and all the myriad of other things that may go into your concept of a drink. Now. Equally important, in my last 3 or 4 minutes, though, is that while I think it's a mistake that's made in some of the science to think that you can do the science of non-human cognition in a way you could never even pretend to do it with human cognition, that is, by backing away from this transactional state in folk psychology, science begins with these folk psychological attributions, but it doesn't end with them, okay? So being tethered to folk psychology is what makes cognitive science science rather than science fiction. In other words, if I told you a story about what people are like, that was completely irrelevant to any conception we have about what we are like, you would think that's a very nice story. You're describing Martians, okay? So there has to be some relationship to folk psychology, whether it's a sharpening of the concepts, whether it's giving an error theory, showing what's wrong with these common sense concepts that we have. But the point is to sort of transcend these folk psychological concepts. And cognitive science then goes beyond folk psychology in regimenting the slackness in our attributions and reshaping our concepts as it develops. So I think the science of the glorious mess that is the science of animal minds can progress, but it must begin with the transactional perspective and not sort of pretend that the animals that are being studied are sort of neutrinos in a cloud chamber. And it must develop shared methodologies and concepts while at the same time recognizing that a decisive moment or a crucial experiment is always to some extent in the mind of the beholder or in the practices of science. People can always go on with alternative perspectives. This science matters. I think it's a very important science. First of all, for animal welfare, we keep many, many animals under our care for whom we are responsible. And knowing something about their cognitive states is very important to guaranteeing their welfare. Increasingly, conservation in the wild is not about leaving animals alone, but trying to understand how to manage animals and manage people, and that requires a much greater sophisticated knowledge, both of the animals and of ourselves, in order to do that. And these questions of human identity, who are we really, what is our relationship to other animals in nature, are important questions that aren't going to go away. And finally, where science withers, ignorance blooms. Thank you.